Sometimes presented by one of our own membership, sometimes by a member of the wider community, and sometimes by our minister, Rob Dixensky. Today we have Sean Peters, and you'll be hearing a little bit more about him today from Bob Park. He's going to be presenting Religious Convictions, Reflections on Faith, Healing, Children, and the Law. And our opening words will be read by Christine Clark.
Today, our opening words are from an excerpt from the Humanist Manifesto. Ethical values are derived from human need and interest as tested by experience. Humanists ground values in human welfare, shaped by human experience, circumstances, interests, and concerns, and extended to the global ecosystem and beyond. We are committed to treating each person as having inherent worth and dignity, and to making informed choices in a context of freedom consonant with responsibility.
Our first hymn is Morning Has Broken, number 38, accompanied by Ivy Nettleton and Christine.
Baseball.
today will also be read by Christina Hoff, and they are in your order of service. And after the words, we will have a minute of silent reflection.
These words are from Kabir. Don't go outside your house to see flowers. My friend, don't bother with that excursion. Inside your body there are flowers. One flower has 1,000 petals. That will do for a place to sit. Sitting there, you'll have a glimpse of beauty inside the body and out of it, before gardens and after gardens.
Here in community, we now take the time to briefly share any special joys, sorrows, or concerns with our community. And please wait for the microphone. Susan has it. Anyone?
It's joyful to be here after several Sundays' absence. I've been on a bike ride. I still could go 85 miles on the longest day. Oh, but at a price. The spine is collapsing. An injection is scheduled for this week. So that's the sorrow part. But also, I attended a week-long Midwest Unitarian Universalist Summer Assembly. This is a week-long event every year for over 40 years. It used to be at Lake Geneva. Has now been moved to a very lovely spot in, of all places, Missouri. It's a YMCA camp, lots of activities, about 100 kids out of 400 attendees, and I would encourage you to consider it for next summer. I also had my 50th high school reunion this weekend, so I've been hopping. And it's a great day.
I don't often do this, so today I feel very, very joyful. Number one, you may not know that earlier this year, at the 1st of February, I had ice damming on my roof and have spent the last 4 months in lawsuits and everything else because they wanted over $4,000, almost $5,000, to get the snow off my roof. And the insurance company refused to pay that amount of money, said it was ridiculous, which it was, and the contractor sued me. So I just got a notice the other day, finally settling this whole thing and saying that I was not to blame, and therefore I didn't have to pay anything to this guy. He got plenty of money to begin with, but I didn't have to. He didn't win his suit. So that was a wonderful joy. And then after carrying buckets of water, which had been leaking through my roof since February, I finally got a notice saying the roofers were going to get there on Monday or tomorrow morning to finally repair and put a new roof on my house. And One sorrow is that this is the third roof I've had put on my house since 2005. And I hope to God it's the last.
How's your basement?
I'm afraid to go down there.
Don't.
We had an interesting experience last week. As you know, John and I were in the Peace Corps 40 years ago, and there's an archivist who is collecting interviews from the Peace Corps volunteers on the spectrum, and he is living with a good friend of ours in the Madison Peace Corps, Return Peace Corps volunteer group. And so they asked if they could come to our house and interview us separately, one upstairs and one downstairs. The neat thing was how when you talk about it, someone is really interested, you get right back into that experience again. And it was a very lovely experience. And any others in this group or former Peace Corps volunteers, let me know and I will get you in touch with these people. They came to our house. Oh, we were in Afghanistan.
I wasn't able to be here a couple of weeks ago, the last Sunday in June. We had a family reunion in Illinois that I organized. My cousins and I haven't got together since my mother's funeral 2 years ago. It was just a wonderful coming together from California, New Orleans, Virginia. And I wanted to especially mention my cousin from New Orleans told me how the money that Prairie raised and sent to her came at such a bad time for her. She was so thankful that we were able to help her out. My second joy is yesterday we had an orientation here this morning, attended by 10 people.
Ooh.
It was great. It went very well. It was so good to get together. Almost half the participants have already joined. They had just missed an orientation, but we have two new members and a third who intends to sign.
That's wonderful.
Well, my joy, a couple of joys. Maya came back Friday from Girl Scout camp, so she's already been and gone to her two camps this summer, so I'm glad that's over. It's always a lot of stress on the family getting to and from camp. And then yesterday was my 58th birthday.
Then we get to move on to our presentation. And I will introduce Bob, who will introduce our speaker today.
I'm very pleased to welcome to the podium today author and UW lecturer Sean Francis Peters. Dr. Peters completed his PhD at UW-Madison last year. And has a BA from Rutgers 1988, MA from Iowa 1995. He has worked at the UW-Madison in a variety of capacities since 1998 and will be teaching in religious studies at UW-Oshkosh next year. In the past, he has taught in a variety of disciplines at universities in New Hampshire, Iowa, Wisconsin, and he did a bit of classwork in law in grad school, but describes himself as much more of a historian and journalist. He grew up in a Catholic family in Catonsville, Maryland, site of the Catonsville Nine draft protest in 1968, in which the Berrigan brothers and seven others seized and burned draft files. Watch for his next book on that topic. His most recent book is When Prayer Fails, Faith Healing, Children, and the Law, Oxford University Press, October 2007. Two earlier books are available from our South Central Library System, Judging Jehovah's Witnesses, Religious Persecution and the Dawn of the Rights Revolution, 2000, and The Yoder Case, Religious Freedom, Education, and Parental Rights, 2003, the book I mentioned last Sunday dealing with a dispute over application of compulsory education requirements to an Amish community in New Glarus, Wisconsin, which went to the U.S. Supreme Court. Today, we will hear him talking to us about religious convictions, reflections on faith, healing, children, and the law. Dr. Peters.
Thank you. Robert, I've been given very specific instructions about the microphone. And I will try to adhere to those. Is this going to work?
Yes.
My booming voice will carry.
Do one more thing.
That is more to my liking. As a tall person, this is not the first time I have encountered this logistical problem. Thank you, Bob, for that generous introduction, and thank you all for inviting me here to share these ideas with you today. Earlier this week, I thought I might have to kind of paddle and portage my way over here because of the rain. But luckily, I was able to just drive my Toyota this morning. As Bob mentioned, I'll be speaking on faith healing children in the law today. And unfortunately, it's a topic that is, it's been in the news quite a bit of late. There's been a prominent case of this in Wisconsin, in the town of Weston, which is north of here. It's near Wausau. In which an 11-year-old girl died on Easter Sunday after her parents chose to treat her diabetes strictly with prayer rather than seeking the medical treatment that almost certainly would have preserved her life, and that being diabetes. There's a case in Wisconsin. There are two cases going on that are very similar, unfortunately, in the state of Oregon. The facts and the law are kind of roughly the same. And so these are not simply things that some egghead historian cares about in some obscure way. They're actually in the news quite a bit. I thought maybe what I would do is briefly speak about religion and law broadly as a way to kind of lead up to the nuts and bolts of those cases, to provide a little bit of a context and a framework for understanding faith healing children and the law a little bit more fully. I think it's probably important. Most discussions in religion and law begin with the First Amendment. The First Amendment, as you know, protects the right to the free exercise of religion. That doesn't mean you can do anything you want legally in the name of religion, just as there are limitations on speech, limitations on freedom of the press, there are limitations on religious conduct. And we can look for a second at sort of how those limitations have developed. It's worth noting, too, that these are issues that are actually a relatively recent vintage in American courts. There really isn't a significant religious liberty case heard by the United States Supreme Court until the 1870s. Once they get into the system, though, starting in the late 19th century, more of them happen and are heard by the courts, and standards sort of percolate through. One of these standards, and it's an important one to think about, is a distinction between religious beliefs and religious conduct. Oftentimes when I speak to people, they think that an important distinction legally is between sort of good religion and bad religion, or legitimate religion and illegitimate religion, and that good religion is protected and that bad religion is not protected. That actually seeps in some, and the courts do privilege certain kinds of religious practices over others. But generally, the first important distinction is between belief and conduct. And the idea is that belief is sacrosanct. Belief, your religious ideology, really can't be messed with by the state through coercion, through regulation. However, how you act on the basis of those beliefs can be regulated as it relates to the state's interest in controlling public order, maintaining safety, and just sort of doing the police stuff that the state does. In the courts, this plays out first in the case of, most significantly, in the case of polygamy, which as a historian, this has been kind of an interesting 6 months or so. Faith healing, polygamy, there are these religious liberty issues dating from the late 19th century that are still with us today, right? Warren Jeffs and the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints in Texas are in the news. Faith healing is in the news, which says something, I think, about how easy it is to sort of manage these kinds of issues through the implementation of public policy. It's actually very difficult to do. In the case of polygamy, Mormons claimed in the 1870s that plural marriage was a bona fide religious practice, and that as such should be protected by the First Amendment. They were freely exercised. To be able to freely exercise their religion, their practice of polygamy had to be protected. The Supreme Court was kind of skeptical of that claim. Sort of scoffed at the idea that it was a legitimate religious practice, and instead, marriage is a civil institution. The state can regulate it, and if the state wants to prohibit polygamy, it can. That is the first sort of meaningful Supreme Court decision in this area. Next come the Jehovah's Witnesses. Bob mentioned I could bore you for the next several hours talking about the Jehovah's Witnesses. I will not do that, fortunately. The Witnesses, during the 1930s and 40s, sort of the World War II era, the Witnesses are involved in this flood of litigation at all levels of the courts. Hundreds of lower court cases involving the Jehovah's Witnesses, 23 United States Supreme Court decisions involving the Jehovah's Witnesses between 1938 and 1946. So if they ever... you know, when you go to the coffee shop or the sub store and they give you that punch card for being a frequent user, the Jehovah's Witnesses would have filled up several of those little punch cards. They kept going to the Supreme Court over and over. The at issue were the witnesses' religious practices, specifically two of them mainly, religious proselytizing. Going door to door, many of you I'm sure have experienced this. Soliciting, selling copies of the Watchtower, distributing Bibles, distributing tracts. The Witnesses define that as worship in the way we're all doing this today. For them, the church is sort of, the street is sort of their church. That's one issue. The second issue was their refusal to salute the American flag on the grounds that it was a form of religious idolatry. Over time, many of the courts look at these cases over and over again. The proselytizing cases involve efforts to suppress witness proselytizing. Witnesses would sort of descend on small towns and annoy people. The town council would get together and say, what are we going to do with these witnesses? Let's ban religious proselytizing. There are lots of cases like that. In general, the courts said there's kind of a balance that needs to be struck. And that the state does have an interest in regulating stuff, but in this case, the witnesses' religious liberty is more significant. And so, not in every case in every jurisdiction, but in general, the witnesses win those cases. And so, there's this kind of evolution of a standard weighing on one hand an individual's religious practice and the need to protect that kind of religious practice, which we think is important and is codified in the First Amendment, but also respecting the state's duty to exercise its police power. Now, Bob also mentioned, this is my kind of thing, so I've written books about this stuff. The next really significant case involves the Old Order Amish in New Glarus, just down the road in Greene County. Starting in 1968, there's a case involving the enforcement of the state's compulsory attendance law. Says that you need to go to school until you're 16. The Old Order Amish believe in formal education only up until the age of 14. They think that anything beyond that would be kind of corrupting and that their kids will become sort of too worldly and that it will threaten their religious community. Those extra 2 years would be a threat. Supreme Court sided with the Amish in that case. And really, that's the high watermark for judicial protection for religious liberty. That's the most protection. It's a very expansive ruling that gives religious practices their most sort of substantive protection from the courts. After that, there's kind of diminution of these protections. It becomes easier for states to regulate religious conduct. There's this thing called the rational basis test, which seems kind of a misnomer to me when we're talking about state regulation. But famously, in the case of the ceremonial use of peyote by Native Americans, the Supreme Court said that the state of Oregon could, even though Native Americans had a long tradition sort of predating the white settlement of the state of Oregon, using peyote for religious purposes, that in fact could be regulated. What happens generally is the courts are generally reluctant to allow the policing of religious conduct. It's a very sensitive area. They sort of bend over backwards to protect individuals who are engaged in worshiping or any of the activities that might sort of be associated with religious worship or religious practice. It's a sensitive area, and these cases generally leave people with a bad taste in their mouths. The individuals who are prosecuted feel like they're being persecuted for their religious beliefs. Prosecutors politically don't tend to really get much traction or benefit from hauling Amish into court, right? They're very sympathetic defendants. And so law enforcement is wary of getting involved in these cases. Now, that brings me back to faith healing in the law. In the United States, there have been legal cases involving faith healing basically dating from the late 19th century. In England, somewhat earlier than that, maybe the 1840s and the 1850s. These cases typically don't involve adults. Generally, the courts have said, if you're a competent adult, you're free to sort of make your own medical decisions. Pregnant women are a different, more complicated class, and I would exclude them from that sweeping generalization. But generally, the courts have said, you can do what you want to yourself if you're competent. Children are another matter entirely. We see in the 19th century the development of protections for the rights of children, and also for the recognition that the state can have a duty to intervene between parents and their children. If parents are engaging in behavior that might be harmful to children, the state's job is to step in and to protect the child. In that framework, cases involving the attempted prosecution of parents for failing to provide medical treatment for their children begin to emerge. And the question is, specifically, and this is a question that really hasn't changed since maybe 1880 or 1890, do parents have a specific legal duty to provide medical treatment to their children, even when the doctrines of their religious faith prohibit the use of medicine and mandate prayer instead? That is the question. And the short answer is, yes. They do have a legal duty. If you go back to that balancing test that I was talking about, on one hand, you have religious healing traditions. They've been around for a long time, certainly in the Christian scriptures. You can look at many Christian faiths have engaged in some variety or another of religious healing practices, and not only Christians, many other faiths. It is a religious practice. So the parents do have an interest. But here we have the state's interest. And the state's interest is really paramount, right? It's protecting life. It might be the most important thing that the state does. And so when you balance those two things, more or less the state wins. The state's interest in preserving life is more important as a legal matter than protecting individuals in this particular legal practice. So you would think that it's a pretty easy legal issue, right, based on what I've just described to you. But it is not. It's complicated because most states have specific provisions in their child abuse code that specifically exempt parents from prosecution when they substitute prayer for medicine. Wisconsin is one of more than 30 states that has a very direct, clear exemption for that kind of conduct. I won't get into the genesis of where these things, where these provisions came from, except to say that in the mid-1970s, there was a federal mandate that came down to states that they, if they wanted to receive ongoing federal funding from what was then the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, they needed to have provisions like this in their codes. The federal government eventually realized that that represented an establishment clause issue, and eventually that mandate was rescinded in 1983, but the states had already changed their laws and didn't remove these exemptions. The exemptions kind of lurk in the code. People don't really pay attention to them until they complicate prosecutions of parents who engage in faith healing in lieu of providing medical treatment. Which brings me to the Karen Newman case here in Wisconsin. I won't get too far into the details of her death, except to say that she essentially died from diabetes, and everyone who I know who has looked at the medical evidence in the case has said that a regimen of insulin would have preserved her life. Her parents have been charged with second-degree reckless homicide, and that's kind of our version of manslaughter here in Wisconsin. They haven't been charged under Wisconsin's child abuse law. They can't really be charged under Wisconsin's child abuse law because of this religious healing exemption that can apply specifically to parents who engage in faith healing. Needless to say, the legal issues in this case will be complex. I think potentially, if the parents are convicted and there is an appeal, there will be a matter of kind of conflicting interpretations of the law. On one hand, the child abuse law says to parents, you can engage in faith healing and not take your child to a doctor. On the other hand, the district attorney in Marathon County has applied the second degree reckless homicide statute and said, wait a minute, this conduct is not protected by the law. She's trying to do an end run around that religious healing exemption. Now, this is what's known as a due process of law issue. The parents, if they are convicted, I am sure, will say, this is too confusing. My right to due process of law has been violated because we have two kind of mutually exclusive things going on. On one hand, the child abuse law says I could be a faith healer, but on the other hand, the prosecutor in Marathon County has said, I can't. What to believe? This isn't a very sexy argument. The parents' attorneys in this case, I've heard them speak publicly, and they seem to want to make a straight kind of First Amendment argument that this is religion. You can't prosecute people for engaging in religious behavior. That'll never work. It sounds really good, and I think that it has kind of visceral appeal. This kind of boring due process of law issue is actually much more, will be much more effective. There have been other cases in other jurisdictions where it has actually worked. Parents have had their convictions overturned on the basis of this due process claim. The solution is to just remove the exemption from the code. That's the way you get around that problem. And in fact, in those other cases, the courts have said, we wish we could uphold these convictions, but we can't. The legislature needs to take action. It's not the business of the courts to do that. As the Newman case has unfolded, and also these analogous cases in Oregon have unfolded, I've been kind of bombarded with questions from people. And the most frequent one, and it's really, I think, the most profound and significant question really is, how could the parents have done this? How could they have denied the treatment to their child that almost certainly would have saved that child's life? And I'm not going to stand up and kind of defend their conduct. I mentioned to a few people before we got started today, I have two children, one of whom is 3, one of whom is 7. We worship at the church of Dean Care, our HMO. It's where we go for this kind of thing. So my worldview is completely different than the worldview of these parents. But as someone who's written, I've written and looked at hundreds of these cases, I've really, really tried to kind of step back and see where they're coming from. Not to defend, but to just kind of comprehend. And what I can say is that the parents believed they were doing what was best for their child. We can look at it now and say they erred grievously and that they should have known better. In terms of their worldview, they did what they thought was right. They did not honestly think that treating their daughter with medicine would work. It's never the case in these sorts of deaths where the parents just sort of concoct a crazy, they mess up and they concoct a crazy excuse and say, I'll just say I'm a faith healer. I know the medicine would work, but I'll just to get away with it, I will say that we believe this. They really sincerely did not believe that medicine, as outlandish as that might sound to us, they didn't believe that medicine would work. And further, they believed that medical treatment was not in accordance with the Word of God, specifically the Epistle of James. There's a passage in James that seems to mandate prayer and anointment with oil for the treatment of disease rather than the use of physicians. I'm also asked, the second question is, what do I think should happen legally in these cases? And I have to be honest, I'm really ambivalent about this problem being resolved in the courts. The courts are really a horrible place to resolve complex social and cultural problems. Case study number one is the drug problem, right? The enforcing drug laws, incarcerating people, really hasn't done very much to solve that issue. And further, as I was driving over here, I was trying to think of a successful instance of state regulation of religious behavior in the United States where the state has said, we're going to enforce a law and stop you from doing this. And it really doesn't work very well. Polygamy is the classic example. 1878 was the year that the Supreme Court said that polygamy could be banned. And still today, it's ongoing. And what's worse is that it gets kind of driven underground away from scrutiny. And in fact, revamped laws and really aggressive prosecutions under them don't necessarily work to protect children who are imperiled by these kinds of practices. Oregon is an example of this. About 8 years ago, Oregon changed its laws to make it easier to prosecute parents in these kinds of circumstances. They had one of these exemptions. They removed the exemption, and everyone thought, aha, this will be great. Parents will be deterred now from engaging in this kind of conduct because they know that they're going to go to jail. This will stop them. Lo and behold, we've had a couple of reported deaths, the deaths we know about, and my sense is that there have been other deaths that we haven't known about. The enforcement of these laws as a deterrent is not necessarily very effective. Devout individuals do not always fear temporal earthly punishment. The punishment and the judgment that they are concerned with is not going to happen here. It's going to happen in the hereafter. And we've seen cases where parents have lost multiple children. They'll lose a child, they'll be prosecuted, they'll get probation or go to jail, they'll get out of jail, and they'll say, my beliefs really are unshaken by this experience. My child's death, really, it was God's will, and I'm going to keep doing what I do in terms of my faith. People like me, academics like to show up and pontificate and say that we have the answers, right? If everybody just listened to me, the world would be a better place, and I'm the expert, and I know. I guess I'm older now, and I'm really reluctant to do that, and I won't. I will say, and as I kind of wrap up, I'm really struck by the lack of dialogue and the lack of conversation on this topic. You have faith healers, child welfare advocates, prosecutors, legislators, medical ethicists, all of whom speak about this topic but don't necessarily speak to one another in a meaningful, productive way. I think we might do better outside the context of law enforcement to bring those people together somehow and to have a discussion that's really grounded on the thing that unites all of them, and that is a concern for the welfare of children. Thanks. And I think...
You keep the mic.
Okay.
And we'll have an opportunity for discussion, and Susan will be carrying
it. All right. I'm a real pacer, so that was... You just witnessed me. Really assuring. Yes.
Jason, wait. Is there any possibility discussion about a parent or parents who have a history of this, and somehow the state intervening with the rest of their children, maybe somewhere short of taking them away, but at least mandating and checking up on them?
That has happened. That, right, that's the trick, is that you prosecuting, dealing with the parents after the child has died, in some ways,
it doesn't really,
what you want to do is engage the parents before that. And the difficulty is penetrating these religious communities and finding out that the child has been endangered soon enough so that you can do that. There have been cases where child welfare authorities have found out about endangered children. It might be a neighbor, a teacher. Someone will say, hey, something's going on next door, and child protection needs to come in. It does happen, and sometimes in cases, part of the sentence will be, the parent will be put on probation, and then there will be a stipulation, the surviving children must receive medical treatment. In the Newman case, it's an ongoing case, but at one point the surviving children were removed from their custody. I think that the Newmans now are under orders, as the case is pending, that their surviving children must receive medical treatment. But again, there's no guarantee that they will actually get it. And that's what makes it. It's really hard to find out beforehand. There's a real, the reporting of this stuff, it's like the deaths that we know about are the tip of the iceberg. There are maybe 10 or 15 reported deaths a year, but they're much more, we just don't know.
I have two comments. One is, I deal with the
No.
No. What is... Can you hear me now?
No.
There you go. One is, I deal with adult patients, not children, but when the question of Jehovah's Witnesses comes up about blood transfusion, I know I might die, but death is not the worst thing. Mm-hmm. The worst thing would be to go against the religious law as I see it. And the same argument is used for children. I know I don't want my child to die. These people don't say that the medicine won't help. Keep the child alive, but that's not their goal. But in that case, the courts have taken over guardianship of the child for the duration of the requirement for blood transfusion.
Right.
Because the Jehovah's Witnesses do accept medical treatment. They
right.
just don't accept blood.
And that's it. It's an interesting example where the child will kind of be in the orbit of control, right? They'll come into the hospital, and so there are lots of people watching, and then when it gets to the point of the transfusion, they will say, stop, and then there can be some kind of control.
And
so absolutely,
say it's not my fault. The court took my child away.
Right. I actually think that many people in these states really, some of them are secretly relieved when that happens. There are kind of hints of that where they some of them are ambivalent. It's really hard to get them to talk about it, and certainly in court they don't. But there are hints of that. Absolutely. Yeah.
Couple of questions and then a statement. Did those parents, the Wisconsin child, know what the diagnosis was when they were trying to fix it?
They claim that they didn't. It will often happen in cases like this where the parents will say, geez, I knew my child was kind of sick, but we thought it was the flu. we thought it was something that wasn't, you know, potentially a terminal illness. Again and again that happened. By the time we found out, it was too late. That's what the Newmans are saying then.
When a child in those religious backgrounds dies, is there not a coroner involved who knows what the cause of death was?
Yes. Well, yes and no. There are lots of communities, you know, out west, for instance, where children get buried, died and get buried without anybody else really knowing. There are, rural cemeteries behind churches in a lot of
places. There's no state control over a child being born?
In theory, yes. Not always, in fact. And when there is a coroner or a medical examiner involved, they do make a determination pretty clearly. It's often, for instance, in the Oregon, one of the Oregon cases involved a obstructed bladder, for instance. An obstructed bladder. The child's bladder was obstructed. And the medical examiner said the surgical procedure would have taken minutes. So yeah, the scrutiny comes, but again, the scrutiny comes too late.
Just to mention, I was a child of Christian Scientist, of very deep faith, never saw a doctor until I got married.
Right.
And if I had been with my mother when I had a brain tumor, I wouldn't be here today.
Right.
I didn't need to have children.
In my book has 10 chapters, and 2 of them are about Christian Science. That's how many cases there are.
There are two things I'm thinking. One is that I'm thinking about other countries that provide postnatal care with nurses or at least healthcare trained people to meet with new families or families of new babies, and that could be maybe a step beginning to present at least to families what some of the things are to begin to develop a relationship. They might close it off completely because of their beliefs,
sure.
But we don't have anything like that. Nothing like that in this country. And then the other thing I'm reminded about the cross-cultural examples, like in the Hmong community and in the book of the spirits, is it the spirits catching you and fall?
The spirits catching you and then you fall.
Yeah.
And Fatiman's book.
Yeah. And what? I mean, it's very, very complex, and that is a cross-cultural, but it's really very much, it's the same. It's the world view that you were talking
about. It's interesting. I know a guy who's a shaman, a Hmong shaman. He's a student at the UW, a very fascinating guy, and we've had some really cool discussions about this stuff. And last year he had his appendix taken out, and I said, well, what happened? You know, and he said, we take it as far as we can take it, and then if it's not working, then we will go to a doctor. The Amish are like that too, to a point, where when all else fails, they'll turn it over to very, very reluctantly and kind of ambivalently, and not always completely, but they will. And these beliefs and practices evolve and change over time too, and so the Amish are. The difference is, if we go from Amish church to Amish church, what they believe, can we have reflective triangles on our buggy, all that stuff, really is kind of, there's no sort of comprehensive, you know, edict from the Pope saying, this is the thing. There is no Amish Pope.
With regard to the cultural or religious relativity, the universities have to deal with this in terms of international students and international families. Mm-hmm. And I have a friend who needs to work with the foreign student office, and she said, and this is something that a lot of sympathy for cultural relativity, and she said, it ends when a child is being injured. Mm-hmm. That was her cutoff, and I think that was a cutoff that was accepted by her in her job, that if a child is being punished, which can happen for religious reasons as well as cultural reasons, they're all intertwined. that that was it. I mean, I have no tolerance for that whatsoever. Now, how legal that was, I don't know. But
I think most people, when given the opportunity, will say, "I'll break the so what? I'll break the law, or I'll offend someone if I have to."
And there's one other thing. I think we have needed a big discussion nationally on the psychology of religion in terms of giving oneself over to God's will. I'd like to see psychology of religion taught in sixth grade. Anyway.
I recall a case that I was not directly involved with spinal cord or spinal scoliosis correction, where the physician with a Jehovah's Witness child, where the child bled to death after the surgery because there wasn't enough time, was the child's bleeding to death, to go get the order to get the transfusion to save the child. And ever after that, that particular physician would no longer do this correction on Jehovah's Witness children. I mean, it was just devastating to the physician to lose this young teenage girl. And so I'm wondering if the Wisconsin law was changed, as you talked about, would that have change that outcome in cases like that? Because the child's already in the system, as Mary was talking about.
Well, change the outcome. It might have changed the eventual legal outcome. I mean, I think that's an interesting example, because it was, I think if they had had the time, they could have gotten an order before, but they believed, they were under the impression that they had to get an order, and that thus ran out of time.
Right, the parents were refusing.
Right. I think it would be easier for there to be a broad understanding that, there is mandatory medical, the parents must provide adequate medical treatment, and that would have taken care of it. But to be honest, I mean, physicians are really hard. I mean, it's hard enough dealing with parents and children to begin with, and to further complicate it with these issues is even more difficult. They don't want to get sued. I mean, it's a ridiculous commentary on our sort of litigious culture, but that's part of it, is that their liability, I think, would be enormous if they didn't.
I'm hearing everyone saying that it's wrong to allow someone to die. I mean, this is the overall thought I'm hearing. And I think there's another way of looking at this. And we live in a society today in which we think we should be immortal. That, you know, you go out, people go out and buy kidneys, and you have organ transplants and anything to stay alive. But man was born and meant to die. And if you look back, 100 years, 50 years, 20 years even, there are things that you could become ill from that it was a fait accompli that parent was going to lose that child. And it's grievous and it's heartbreaking, but it's a part of life. And so if you believe strongly enough in your heart and soul that's what's meant to be, I'm not sure that we should take away from the parent the right to have that belief. I mean, I myself don't believe that way completely. I think there are things I would not do to save a life.
what there are things I would do. But I the idea that, you know, we go out and kill people every day. You kill them in the streets, you kill them in the wars, and somehow the idea that the parent, that their belief should not have the privilege to allow their child to die naturally or from whatever it is. There's another way of looking at it.
Sure, I can appreciate that sentiment, and I think it's such a right, this hard ethical question, and I would say that I find that more convincing the more the heroic measures must be taken to preserve the life. So when it is a person is in a vegetative state, for instance, brain dead, whatever, I find it more convincing as we get further down that path. For many of these, though, the medical solutions are so easy. My book starts with a boy in Philadelphia who he died from cutting his foot on a bucket handle in his backyard, and it turned out he didn't feel like. And to me, it's just, when I read about that story, I was just so moved and saddened by how easy it would have been to save that child's life. So that is you've posed a very good heart. That's why I say that I don't have the answers. Because the question's exactly like that.
I have a sort of a legal question. There is a statute in German law that's called Unterlassene Hilfeleistung, which means if a person does not aid and help, if somebody is in danger, that person who doesn't help can be, called into court. Do we have a law like that?
They're called good Samaritan laws.
Oh, yes. I see.
And, Right. And
how is it the opposite?
It
provides protection for people who do really help.
Right.
Instead of
we can't be sued for doing it wrong or
intervening. So for instance, if you were if God forbid you were to have a heart attack and I were to do CPR and somehow harm you, you couldn't sue me.
Well, there's no legal obligation for Ray.
No, there's not.
Oh, okay.
Who gets it?
I guess what I think of the thing is a question, did that child want to die? Not what the parents wanted, but what about the child? Did that child want to die? And I feel the same thing as controlling adults when the child hasn't learned all the ways of living, that it's the same as child seduction and things that adults can't do to children because children don't have understanding or control.
Right, we understand that children aren't competent yet. I will say, one of the Oregon case now, one of these two Oregon cases I talked about involved a boy who was 15. Okay, and the mid-teen years are kind of legally ambiguous. You're not of a majority yet. The parents are claiming that the child was a so-called mature minor and was capable of rendering, understood what the risks were and was mature enough to make that decision. I'm trying to remember when I was 15 and mature, which is not very mature at all, but that's the claim. So the older the child gets, the more that plays in. But obviously when a child is infant, they're obviously not.
I was wondering what the chances were of that exemption where parents are protected from being prosecuted for child abuse. If that exemption is the chances of that are being overturned, taken out of the law, is there any movement with legislatures respond to citizens writing in?
It's interesting. Usually what happens is there's a the
the prosecution will not go for, there'll be a case, the prosecutor will say, oh, I'd like to go forward, but I can't, the law is messed up. There'll be a public outcry, and then lawmakers will kind of lurch into motion. In Wisconsin, because the prosecutor has chosen to do this kind of end run and prosecute the parents under manslaughter, I think people kind of relaxed. When this case first hit, back around Easter, I think many people, I was fully expecting somebody to say, some state legislator to say, today is the day I'm going to work to repeal this law. I think people have said, oh, we don't need to do it. You can prosecute these people under second degree reckless, and it'll work out fine. I think that they're in for a surprise when this case develops. I actually think that it's possible that the case might settle before it even goes to trial. They might plead guilty to a lesser charge. Both sides of this case, it could kind of go either way legally, so it might not actually be fully resolved. But I've actually been really surprised that no one has really stood up and said, we need to, the last chapter of my book is a quotation, and it's, we need to change the statute. And it's from a legislator, I think, in Colorado, and for precisely this.
Thank you, Dr. King.
Oh, thanks so much.
Could he repeat the net title of his book and
the title of your book is in the program,
right?
Yeah, the latest book. I think we could have talked about that for at least another half an hour. It's time for our offertory. Prairie runs on love and volunteer help and also financial support. So please put your offerings in the basket and pass the baskets to the ushers, which will be heading down the aisle. Or this is your first time, if you'd be willing to please let us know who you are and what brought you to Prairie today. And Susan has the microphone.
Bill and Norma Cave. We're parents of Bob Cave, and we've been here before. We like this society very much, and we're very happy to be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. I draw your attention to the announcements in your order of service and also to the calendar on the back page, and would ask if anyone has any brief Prairie-related announcements that didn't make it into the order of service. And I think I'll start since I have the microphone. I've had a few people ask me about what's going on with the land that we're selling in Fitchburg, or hoping to be selling. I told people a couple of weeks ago that I was hoping we would have an answer very shortly. The people who we are currently working with to attempt to sell our land had asked for an extension on satisfying certain contingencies that they had. And that extension is to tomorrow. And our expectation is that tomorrow we will hear that the contingency has been satisfied. So I'm hoping that tomorrow I can put out an email saying, you know, we're going to sell our land. But we haven't heard that, so I can't say that. The proposed closing was by July 31st. So if we get the good news tomorrow, then by the end of this month we will be selling that land. So hopefully, those of you who do get Prairie News, watch your email in the next couple days. Anyone else?
A bit of trivia, maybe. Garden out here, our prairie garden. You should really look rather closely at it. Those enormous tall plants, which are, well, about 8 feet tall, well over my head, are compass plants in the sunflower family. And they're the biggest I've ever seen. All this rain is good. And they're just starting to flower. They're called compass plants because the many of the leaves, not all of them, the lower leaves especially, are oriented more or less north and south. If you go and look at those, you can see that. And so they can be used to navigate by. You can get a general idea of the directions you're traveling in. But there's a lot of other things in flower. The other yellow flowers are black-eyed Susans and yellow coneflower, and et cetera, et cetera. It's coming into its height right now.
Mm-hmm. Gee, I'm being very talkative today, but I do want to announce that Nancy Graham is back from Tucson and will be with us for the rest of the summer. And Nancy and I and Sarah Lord were at the UN conference at Edgewood yesterday, which was a wonderful conference, and too bad other prairie people weren't able to come, but we had a very nice experience.
If you know you're going to be here next Sunday, could you consider signing up to help wash up the dishes, wash up the cups? I think we're covered for today. And if you sign up for next Sunday, then I don't have to announce it. So I encourage people to think about that.
Spanish speakers potluck will be August 11th at my house on North Street.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Anyone else? And it's time for our final hymn, number 205, Amazing Grace. And please stand.
Oh,
closing words today will be read by Christina Clark.
Our closing words are from Khalil Gibran, and I hope they touch your heart and your mind. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, they belong not to you. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you. For life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday.
Thank you to all of those who helped put our service together today. Please greet your neighbor and join us for coffee and refreshments after the service. Go in peace.
Thank you.